Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 377. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois. I'm back with another episode and another great, excellent group of panelists. Let me introduce to you first our regular. We have Jim Cassidy, who's organizing pastor at South Austin OPC down in Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim. It's good to speak with you again this afternoon.
Excellent. Good to be here, Camden. Just need to correct you on one thing. No longer organizing pastor, but
You particularized.
We particularized by God's grace. We're very thankful to the Lord for that. And we've moved from the status of being a mission work to being a particular congregation. Me from being an associate pastor of Providence Church to being the pastor of South Austin. But we're just thrilled by God's grace in our lives here in Austin. So
I knew that. I think I was referring to organizing in terms of the pastor who organized it.
Yeah.
But his title is just a pastor. He's no longer church planter or, as you said, associate over in Pflugerville. We're delighted to hear that. And congratulations. And we pray the Lord's blessings upon the work there and ask that the Lord would continue to grow it. But it's great news, Jim.
Thank you. Appreciate your prayers. Appreciate your words of encouragement.
Yeah, today we're also welcoming to the program, but as a guest, not as a regular panelist, we're welcoming back to the program Carlton Wynn, who is lecturer in apologetics and systematic theology at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Carlton. It's good to talk to you as well.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here.
Yeah, Carlton has written a dissertation. It's it's been submitted, I guess, and very soon should be accepted and all the I's dotted and T's crossed and should graduate very soon. He's written a PhD dissertation on Wolfhart Pannenberg. Today we're going to be speaking about Pannenberg and modern theology and trying to get a good picture, a portrait of who Pannenberg is and was and what his significance is for the church and for modern theology. And hopefully we can get a good grasp on a solid critique of Pannenberg's theology as well. But before we get into our main topic of discussion, I want to mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported. We rely on the generous support of all of our listeners and viewers to help us do what we love doing, that's discussing theology and putting theological resources out for people who want to learn and grow in their understanding of the Reformed tradition, and more importantly than that, more foundationally, in the Scriptures. So we encourage you to visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate. There you can pledge your support, and you can partner with us with a monthly gift or weekly gift or biweekly or one time, whatever you want to do. You can customize something of significance and of meaning for you, and we just really appreciate any gift, whether it's $2 a month or, you know, $50, $100 a month. We have some of those, and we just love the support that we receive. Any bit helps, and we want to do more work and accomplish more of our objectives and goals, and we want to partner with you in our mission to promote Reformed theology through Christian education. But to do that, we need your help. We want to thank you so much for everything you do in supporting us here at Reformed Forum in this particular program, Christ the Center. Now, Jim, I guess you and I are familiar with some aspects of modern theology, having studied Karl Barth and Karl Rahner, respectively, but we're kind of rounding out a triumvirate here with Wolfhart Pannenberg. I love saying Wolfhart, and people probably think I'm mispronouncing it, but I'm just using the German, the Deutsch. And Pannenberg is a massively influential and important figure. But Jim, I want to start with you, even though this is kind of improper to not ask the guest a question.
It's okay.
Carlton's been with us before, so he knows. So Jim, what do you know about Pannenberg, and how have you come across him? I want to ask an outsider first, not someone who's written his dissertation on Pannenberg, because Carlton's been in the thick of things for a long time, and he's a mole man. He hasn't come out of his mole hole yet. So, Jim, what do you know about Pannenberg for the rest of us?
Not much. Especially,
you know more than most.
Especially
not Carlton,
compared,
but no more than most.
Not as much as Carlton. So I'll go ahead and set myself up, and then Carlton can fix me and my perspective here. But I think that I was able to take a PhD seminar on Pannenberg and some of his thought, focusing mostly on his Christology. And so the way I understand Pannenberg is that he has this And I'm going to try to break down some of the language here so that we don't get overly technical and those who perhaps haven't read Pannenberg might have access to kind of the concepts that we're trying to put together, put out there for a better understanding. And I'm really interested in hearing Carlton give to us a little bit of background on Pannenberg, his history, maybe a little bio or whatever, which will set up, I think, the importance for our listener with regard to why Pannenberg is important, why we need to kind of be wrestling and engaging with his thought. But basically, from what I understand, it's a it is an approach to theology that is it is driven by eschatology, eschatology, or what he calls the future of God, whereby the end of history has what we might call a retroactive effect on our understanding and the being, particularly of God. God is, we might use the word constituted, or he is rendered the God who he is by virtue of the end of time history having a retroactive or a backwards effect upon God who has revealed himself through history. So now that I've completely muffed up my understanding here of Pattenberg's theology, I let's turn it over to Carlton so that he can fix us and make it a little bit more muddier than what it already is.
Jim, I'm happy to become a panelist, and I'll just start asking you more questions. That was great. I thought that was very helpful. In fact, I would have loved to have had Jim with me while I'm writing this thing, because Pannenberg is in many ways responding to Karl Barth. Mm-hmm. And there were many times that I wished I had Jim here to bounce some ideas off of in reading Pannenberg's thought. But Jim's absolutely correct. Pannenberg is often considered the latest and greatest truly systematic thinker since Karl Barth. He is in many ways, he studied under Barth for at least one semester, but if we're situating him vis-a-vis Barth, I think it's helpful to say that Pannenberg wants to reintegrate revelation and ordinary history to the furthest extent possible. He believes that the dialectical theologians of Barth and Bultmann have introduced a dualism between ordinary, examinable history and the theological significance of Jesus of Nazareth, of the resurrection, of the end of time. And he wants to reintegrate what he perceives dialectical theology has torn apart in an effort to re-legitimize the Christian faith in a post-Enlightenment world that values rational, critical inquiry. He doesn't want to revert to classic liberalism. He wants to receive the lessons that liberalism has learned in its inability to penetrate to the theological significance of reconstructed biblical history. But he wants to do so without going in a neo-Orthodox direction that for him is functionally equivalent to a pietistic leap into the dark. He wants it to be rationally accessible to scientific inquiry, but in a way that doesn't lose any transcendent theological significance of history and the history of Jesus in particular.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's an apologetic edge to his theologizing then. Is that an accurate thing to say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, he says, one of the quotes that I like, he says, for much too long a time, faith has been misunderstood to be subjectivity's fortress into which Christianity could retreat from the attacks of scientific knowledge.
Spot on. Wow.
And he wants to bring faith out from this pious, storm-free zone, as he puts it, and expose it to the rational investigations of historians and scientists. And he believes that he can do so with confidence because he believes that the very process of historical analysis and scientific analysis at least open up the question of God. And in particular, they do so by situating analysis of historical events within their context. And he believes that the widest context is the entirety of history. And when we bring into view the totality of world history, that necessarily brings up the question of the unity of history, and that in turn brings up the question of God, that all things are related to the God who will one day unite the discrete particulars of history in, ultimately under the preaching of Jesus, in his reign as king, mm-hmm. in his final kingdom. And so he believes that all of our rational inquiry of history can be subsumed into a grander theological, metaphysical, Trinitarian vision that substantiates the Christian faith today.
Having that foundation and understanding of Pannenberg's basic project might be helpful to situate him historically so that we might understand. We've already mentioned Barth being a contemporary, but who was Wolfhard Pannenberg, and could you give us some brief biographical details so that we might know more about him?
Yeah, sure. He was born in 1928, and he actually died last year, which has been an interesting phenomenon writing on him. He died last September. He was born into the Lutheran tradition, though his parents were not believers, not Christians. He endured the horrors of World War II and watched as his home got destroyed by bombing raids from American and British forces. He was forced into the Hitler Youth Movement and eventually joined the German army, though he was captured by the British, and which probably kept him from dying in fighting against the Russians. And these tragic, war-torn experiences ended up inoculating him from expecting any kind of this-worldly utopian vision. He read Marx. He read Nietzsche. He was impressed with the philosophical breadth of their systems of thought. And yet, he continually turned in a post-war setting to the future as a key category for doing theology. He eventually came to believe through the instrumentality of a high school teacher that Christianity offered some resources for making sense of the world, but he wanted to do so as a post-Enlightenment thinker. He's a thoroughly modern thinker, but one who at the same time believes, as we mentioned, Christianity can provide the most plausible explanation for the realities of human experience. He went to Heidelberg and studied under Gerhard von Rad, whose hermeneutical method, his reading of the Old Testament as a series of reactualized interpretations of Israel's history, becomes determinative, which is really interesting. He gathered with a group of graduate students to try to take von Rad's hermeneutic and explore what a systematic theology would look like on the basis of his exegetical vision. He was influenced as well. We mentioned Barth and Bultmann mainly as foils for his own theology. And philosophically, if there's a philosopher that stands behind Pannenberg that people typically mention, it's G.W.F. Hegel, though he departed from Hegel in certain ways. Especially, he insisted that the process of history was open and thoroughly contingent. And for that reason, he's also been influential in some quasi-evangelical circles in the open theist movement. Mm. Sometimes I call him the godfather of open theism. He has influenced Clark Pinnock and Stanley Grenz and some others who want to do theology with one foot in kind of the postmodern world, and yet not capitulate entirely to a relativistic understanding of truth. So that's kind of the broad sweep of the trajectory of his career and some of his influences and those whom he's influenced.
It's interesting that you see the Hegelian project there trying to reconcile the absolute with history, but there is a tension that is recognized within Pannenberg's system that he does depend upon the absolute being the end of the project or the end of history, and there's a retroactive feature that the present is somehow conditioned and constituted by the future absolute in Hegelian terms, but at the same time, that future is entirely open. And it seems, you know, you end up with some sort of a dialectical relationship between the two, which no doubt is a function of Hegelian thinking itself. I was also interested here. I was looking through in preparation for this interview, looking through Modern Christian Thought, the 20th Century, which is a volume of wonderful collections on different thinkers in modern theology. There's a lot of contributors to this: James Livingston, Francis Schisler, Fiorenza. The latter wrote the chapter on Pannenberg, and I was really impressed by the similarities with the thought of Karl Rahner in several places. And it says Pannenberg himself saw many themes in Rahner's project that he liked, and he leaned upon some of those. And many people have even said Pannenberg is close to transcendental Thomism. You ever run into anything like that before, Carlton?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. He was a member of a particular ecumenical council of the World Council of Churches. And he did a lot of ecumenical dialogue with Roman Catholics, and you're absolutely right, did have a lot of appreciation for Karl Rahner. You know, one of the ways, at least in my writing on Pannenberg, that Rahner enters in is with the famous Rahner's Rule, right, that determines so much Trinitarian theology in the modern scene. Pannenberg takes up Rahner's Rule, which you can elaborate on that, Camden, but essentially the idea that the ontological Trinity, God in himself, is identical with, and there's debate over how strongly we want to draw these lines, with mm-hmm. the economic Trinity. And the economic Trinity is the ontological
Trinity. Vice versa. Mm-hmm.
So Pannenberg believes that in order to do justice to Rahner's Rule, the identity of the ontological and economic Trinities, we have to argue that God is in some sense actually dependent upon the process of history to be who he is. And the way that that cashes out in his system is that though the being of God is the ultimate future reality that retroactively overflows into the process of history to give it its provisional partial meaning today, as history is plunging forward. At the same time, history itself is constitutive of the ontological being of God. So in some way, we can say that at least moving forward, the economic Trinity is that which constitutes the ontological Trinity. And yet from the perspective of the future looking back, the ontological Trinity is the source of the economic Trinity's activity. Yep. And it's in the midst of that attempt to substantiate his retroactive ontology that somehow what we perceive today is a proleptic, partial, fleeting, changing anticipation of what the future will bring. And it's only that because the future actually retroactively constitutes that present provisional fleeting anticipation. It's in the midst of that that he brings in Rahner's Rule and attempts in his own way to try to improve on it in its concrete expressions.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating to me. I mean, this whole the whole train of thought, the way in which he's engaging in Rahner's Rule, and he's really in many ways reconstructing the means to that end. It's almost assumed in the current theological scene that there is not a distinction as there was in, let's say, classic scholastic Reformed theology or something, or even before Reformed in classic scholastic theology, a distinction between God and himself and then God who he is for us. And so it's assumed in the modern period that that gap is that gap ought to be non-existent, that distinction, I should say, ought to be non-existent in our theologizing, and then there are different modes of getting to eliminating that distinction. You know, Pannenberg, it seems to me, is giving, perhaps if we could put it this way, a horizontal dialectic that that provides for the elimination of the distinction, whereas maybe BART would be seen as having a vertical kind of solution to the elimination of the distinction, and perhaps also for Rahner. But my question, I guess, in response to that is, in our contemporary setting, especially because Pannenberg has just died, I mean, he's still in many ways a fresh thinker, a fresh conversation partner, interlocutor in the whole current milieu of theological discussion, particularly on the Trinity. But why, in this context, as we've kind of, and I'm sorry for giving such a long question here, but I want to set it up well. I guess the question I'm heading towards is, why study Pannenberg? Why would our listeners be at all interested in understanding this man and his role in the contemporary theological scene, especially if we are coming from a Reformed perspective? We have such a rich resource of theological, of a theological tradition to draw upon, of orthodoxy. Why is it important for us to understand Pannenberg and to study him today?
Well, on the one hand, I think it's important to study Pannenberg because though Karl Barth and his heirs, in some ways post-liberal school, are still in his train, though that is the reigning kind of paradigm for those outside of some of our circles, I do believe that Pannenberg's day has not yet come, and that once people want to reintegrate, as he attempted to do, ordinary history and the revelation of God, right? So the ordinary history doesn't merely witness to something that is super historical. This is his reading of Barth. And they want to provide a rigorous, analytical, rational account of their faith that still recognizes the provisionality of truth, yet doesn't want to jettison truth entirely. That wants a robust metaphysical Trinitarian account of history that doesn't cause them to jettison secular scientific standards. You know, all of these streams of thought and agendas are synthesized in Pannenberg. And I believe that he was so creative in his systematic endeavors that his day has not yet come. He has not yet been appreciated as I expect he will. So in some ways, the dissertation is something of a preemptive examination of his thought before he attains the kind of popularity that a Karl Barth does now. Now, maybe that won't happen, and maybe this is just a wonderful exercise for me. But that leads to my second reason to study Pannenberg. I think he makes us better readers of redemptive history in a backhanded way. You know, when we see a creative mind in a post-Enlightenment setting attempting to reconstrue the meaning of Jesus's preaching and his resurrection and the triune being of God as it relates to history, I think that attunes us more carefully, at least I hope it has me, to the genius of a Vossian understanding of redemptive history. Yeah. To distinguish proleptic, retroactively caused effect of the final future from an inaugurated eschatology and the resurrection of Christ. You know, to see the absolute triune personal God behind the outworking of his decree in time, and to distinguish that from a retroactive understanding of the resurrection that extends back into eternity to constitute the Son as divine. I mean, these kinds of parallels and yet differences, to me, have been very helpful in refining my own Reformed convictions, even though I'm directly engaging with a guy who is far outside my own theological home.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up question, if I could, about the retroactivity, if I could put it that way, of the divine nature of the Son. And I'm confusing as to what are some of the things we discussed about in the pre-show kind of chat that we had, and then the show chat that we've had. But
everyone's going to want that recording.
I know. We could hold on to it and release it only for a special
donation.
It's a
bootleg. It's like the Bob Dylan basement tapes or something. Carlton Wynn basement tapes.
Yeah, it'd be awesome. Worth a fortune, I'm sure.
On vinyl.
Tell us a little bit about the because we had kind of you had rattled off some, you know, pretty technical language there. Break down for us, if you could and would. I know you can, but if you would, break down for us exactly how Pannenberg understands Christ's divinity.
I hope I can do it. That's a big question, Jim. When he's talking about his Christology, we have to keep in mind that on the one hand, as we mentioned, he wants to do justice to the ordinary observable dimensions of history as reconstructed by historical critical methods. And to that extent, he wants to derive the deity of Christ from the phenomena of the life of the historical Jesus. And at the same time, he wants to draw out what he calls pertinent developments of that history within his broader philosophy of history, including his understanding of the way the final future retroactively constitutes the present. And the way he does that in the life of Jesus, in order to conclude for his deity, hinges upon his understanding of the fact and the effect of the resurrection. He believes that the empty tomb tradition and the resurrection appearances, at least probabilistically, substantiate a belief in a literal resurrection from the dead. And for that reason, when his thought became first influential in America, some evangelicals hailed him as the theologian of the resurrection. They said, this guy believes in the bodily resurrection. He's not a liberal critic who's going to dismiss the resurrection as a spiritual only. This is our guy. But the more that the American evangelical scene probed what he meant by the resurrection, it was a different story. Let me just read one quick quote. This is from his book that in English is titled Jesus, God, and Man. It's largely a work about his theological method, but he does include some dogmatics in his Christology in this book. But he says this, Jesus's essence is established retroactively from the perspective of the end of his life, from his resurrection, not only for our knowledge, but in its being. He was not only unrecognizable before Easter, but he would not have been who he was without the Easter event. The Easter event points back to the pre-Easter Jesus, insofar as it has confirmed his pre-Easter claim to authority. Jesus' unity with God, and this is the kicker, Jesus' unity with God established in the Easter event does not begin only with this event. It comes into force retroactively from the perspective of this event. So essentially what he's saying is that the human Jesus of Nazareth declared that his father was bringing a kingdom to bear, and that kingdom was found in himself. However, because of the contingency of his claims, because of the unknown character of the future that lay ahead of him, it was not until the resurrection that not only those claims received their substantial validity, but it was only on the basis of the resurrection and its retroactive causal power that actually constituted Jesus of Nazareth as the divine Son of God, such that from the perspective of the resurrection looking back, we can say that Jesus was one with God in his entire pre-Easter identity. However, from the perspective of Jesus of Nazareth making these claims prior to the resurrection, the jury was still out on his identity because its ultimate reality had not yet been decided. Now, Pannenberg takes that microcosmic model of the way that the humanity, the resurrection, and the consequent retroactively constituted deity of the Son pertains to Jesus, and he extrapolates that out into his entire vision of world history. Just as the resurrection retroactively constitutes Jesus of Nazareth as divine, so too, because the resurrection is a proleptic anticipation of the end of time, the final end of history, when the totality of reality has evolved, only then will the final future retroactively and definitively determine what everything means today. And yet, because Jesus has been raised, because the end of time has been brought forward in his resurrection, that gives us confidence that even now we can assert some provisional truths, even though at the end of the day, we have to wait until the end of time to determine their true and ultimate and definitive meaning. So there's this balance between the life of Jesus and the resurrection and his cosmic view of world history. And in both cases, it is the definitive end, first in the resurrection, then at the end of history, that actually determines the meaning we are to ascribe for now of present events. So that's a long-winded way of trying to get at how he relates Jesus to the divine Son. But it gets a little bit more complicated by the time he writes his systematic theology, because there were those who disagreed, as you can imagine, that he's drawing out all of these theological consequences from the phenomena of Jesus of Nazareth. And some people were taking issue with that, saying, how can you make these conclusions? So in his systematic theology, he comes back around and tries to describe from a divine perspective, from the perspective of the final future, how the history of Jesus emerges from the intra-Trinitarian life of God to come. And you have to really hold these two things together. Early in his career, his focus is very much on the phenomena of history, articulating his cosmic vision of world history, trying to articulate how the resurrection factors into that. But then by the time he writes his systematic, he tries to integrate that into a more robust Trinitarian theology to legitimize his earlier project. So it's kind of fascinating. His whole career is kind of an embodiment of his theological method. The systematic theology gives final shape and retroactive determination to his earlier writings.
Wow. Interesting. Nothing like being consistent anyway, if nothing else, right?
Right. It's really, I mean, he says that the doctrine of God is the final thing that a systematician must write on, because it's the doctrine of God that embraces everything else. And until everything else is settled in his mind, he wasn't going to touch the doctrine of God, which I find really interesting because, yeah. You know, we open up any Reformed systematics text and we're beginning with Scripture and God, right? But not so for Pannenberg. He wrote and acknowledged that everything he was writing was somewhat unstable until the doctrine of God. And yet he said there's no other way to go about these things. We have to investigate everything else before we write a doctrine of God, and yet it's the doctrine of God that gives everything its final validity.
Right.
You know, he spent a lot of time on method, right? One of his major works was the English translation is Theology and the Philosophy of Science, which Fiorenza kind of laments because the German is Wissenschaftstheorie und Theologie. And, you know, that just encapsulates what he's all about in terms of trying to develop an entire intellectual discipline that treats theology seriously. Again, that pulls things back from the subjectivity of the liberals into something of rationality and objectivity that can be studied. But yet it formulates and seems to flesh out his Hegelian notions of this absolute at the end of history in his own creative way.
If I could maybe give voice, you know, because we've kind of put on the table kind of an introduction now to Pannenberg, and if we were to end our episode here, I think we'd have a pretty good show that would be informative for all our folks. So let's have a little fun. let me give voice, if I could, to Bart in terms of how, and I'm not familiar with the secondary critical literature that may have been leveled against Pannenberg's thought, particularly by those more sympathetic with Bart and Bultmann. So, you know, if one of the things, Bart has already, I think that Bart has already given his answer to Pannenberg. In his answer to Brunner, the famous nine that he wrote to Brunner's proposal for recapturing a modern version of natural theology. And I think I wonder, Carlton, if you've given any thought to this and what your thoughts are. I wonder if Barth and the Barthians would not push back on Pannenberg and say what you're doing actually is going back in a certain way. Obviously, there's differences in advancement, but in your own mind anyway, but you're in some ways going back to neo-Protestantism or liberalism with its agenda of apologetics, beginning with the phenomenon, beginning with the things that are rationally provable. And of course, they come to different conclusions, but the starting point from below, as opposed to from above, I think Barth and the Barthians would say to Pannenberg, "You're reverting back to old ways that we thought we had advanced beyond." What do you think of that, Carlton? Does that
Jim,
make sense?
This is a fantastic question. I just reached into my notebook from their seminar on Pannenberg from last semester, and I have a letter here, not the original, but a letter from Barth to Pannenberg. This is dated 1964, December 7th, and he virtually asked the question that you're asking. This is a fascinating quote. He says, I mark you, Dr. Pannenberg, I have read your book, he's talking about Jesus, God, and Man, with a sincere curiosity whether I might be dealing at last with the child of peace and promise, whose work would represent a genuine superior alternative to what I myself have attempted and undertaken in theology in the last 45 years. And then he goes on to say, my first reaction on reading your book was one of horror. When I read on the very first page, I found you rejecting Martin Kollar in a way that led me to suspect that, like others, you intended to pursue a path from below to above. He says, is not this to build a house on sand? The shifting sand of historical probabilities moving one way yesterday and another day today. And he goes on from there, and he says at the end of his letter, I can only regard your own path as reactionary. But then Pannenberg writes back, okay, and this is the answer to your question, Jim, in 1965, May 9th, and of course they're very pleasant with one another in these letters, but Pannenberg replies, of course, I cannot say that I feel that you have understood me. After your friendly reaction to my first effort, I was bold enough to hope that you would perceive in my work a continuation of the basic thought of your theology of revelation in a changed intellectual climate. And then he goes on to defend his appeal to the historical Jesus to build his theology, and then he writes this. It has thus seemed unavoidable that I should start with the historical question of Jesus of Nazareth, since otherwise his historical particularity would be concealed at once by general theological or other concepts. My different approach to the significance of historico-critical biblical investigation for theology is the prominent sign of the change of intellectual climate in comparison with your own work. Might there not be here a limitation in your awareness of the problem with which you once started? And so he goes on to say, look, I have to start with the particular Jesus, otherwise theological concerns become nothing more than a pietistic leap away from the rational questions of modern man. Pannenberg is receiving from Barth, however, the criticism that if you begin with history, Bultmann and I have shown that nothing theologically significant can be gleaned from history. It is all but a witness to the eternal decision of God to be for us in Christ. And so, you know, I find this letter exchange between Barth and Pannenberg so fascinating because, in my view, they're both identifying weaknesses in one another's position, but they're not able to arrive at a solid foundation for doing theology because both of them are operating within a fundamental enlightenment framework. What are your thoughts on that, Jim?
Yeah, that's pretty cool, actually. We didn't plan this for me to ask that question for you to pull out those letters, but it just kind of, being a good scholar that you are, you had these things at your fingertips, and it really brought the light to me because I was following along the conversation, and it really did put a finger on, you know, my questions, my concerns about the relationship between the two. But so my follow-up then, Carlton, is this. I mean, this is kind of the million-dollar question to bring into this conversation now, not just Pannenberg and Bart, but now to bring into this conversation someone like Van Til. And none of our listeners will be surprised that we're bringing Van Til to the table here to sit down, have a conversation with these three, but or these two other guys. But, you know, so I'm thinking in terms of Van Til, who, and I'm not going to steal your thunder here, but let me just think this out. And then I want you to run with it, and just because I know you've given a lot of reflection to this. So somebody like Van Til steps into the conversation. On the one hand, he's kind of sympathetic with Bart because Bart is militating against the idea of evidences historicism and historiography as it's been developed by modernism. And in that sense, you know, Van Til has, you know, there's some some correlation between Van Til and Bart. On the other hand, Van Til believes in the phenomenon as real. I mean, he believes that there are that the truth of the gospel, which takes place in real time history, is in fact verifiable. It's it's something that is tangible, that is real. But on the other hand, it seems like Van Til would have some serious criticisms about Pannenberg's use of history, in the sense that Pannenberg seems to give a certain epistemological primacy to history and the science of history, even over against revelations or biblical revelation. So I guess that's just my convoluted way of setting up for you the question about what would Van Til say to these two guys, do you think, if he were sitting at the table with them?
I think he would, as you put it, I think he would have some sympathies with Bart's reaction against an autonomously contrived analysis of bare history. I also agree that he would have sympathies with, formally speaking, with Pannenberg's appreciation for the legitimacy of historical evidences and the reality of ordinary history for theology. History does exert a meaningful theological role in redemption and in the accomplishment of God's creating and saving purposes. We don't look anywhere else but than the concrete world in which we live as the arena of God's activity. However, one way to answer that question, I think, would be that he would argue that neither Bart nor Pannenberg have penetrated to the deepest presuppositional structures of Enlightenment thinking when it comes to analyzing history. Bart leaves it untouched and says that it's not the realm of theology or the significance of God's redemptive purposes. It's not the realm for investigating those things. Pannenberg would leave those processes of historical analysis unadjusted too. However, he would want to situate them within a wider philosophy of history in which he thinks they make better sense. Van Til is going to bring to bear the absolute self-attesting Christ of Scripture and want to do a penetrating analysis of the very assumptions built into historical analysis. And he's going to want to completely subvert whatever residue of autonomous thinking is built into those processes through a thoroughgoing submission to special revelation. And he believes that it's only in that way that we're going to be doing justice to any kind of intelligible historical and scientific work. So, yeah, I think it's Van Til's analysis and critique of Kantian and Hegelian thought as fundamentally rooted in autonomy that he would take issue with Bart and Pannenberg.
Carlton, there's also a connection here with Rahner once again on that very point. Pannenberg he mentions his appreciation of Rahner on several points. One of them is, this is a quote from Pannenberg, according to Karl Rahner, an unthematized foreconception of being in its unlimited extension is the condition for grasping any finite essences at all. And for Rahner, that feature of his theology is called a foregriff, or it's a pre-apprehension of being. Mm-hmm. And it's God, in a sense, as far as I understand Rahner and his view of epistemology, that there is this primal or deep down grasp or understanding of the mystery that's out there, of this absolute being. And by that grasp, one can compare any finite being or finite existence and therefore understand its particularity. And so for Rahner, the horizon of all existence, the thing that's out there that's in the background, but yet you don't always focus on it, is God himself. And so for Pannenberg, I wonder how he connects this epistemologically. Because if it's the triune God who might be the absolute at the end of history, but constitutes the present, what does that do for humanity and human epistemology in particular? As human beings need some sort of foundation upon which to rest their knowledge and their understanding. But yet, you know, we have an absolute, but it's totally open. What does that do for human thinking? Does Pannenberg address that at all in his, or is it merely just an unresolved tension?
You know, the best that I can say is that it's an unresolved tension, that he presupposes the retroactivity of the future. He presupposes that the future is the Archimedean point that provides the kind of epistemological stability that we're talking about. And yet, as you rightly say, and this was one of the things that makes him so difficult to read, but I think it's at the heart of the conflict in his system, that the final future is both the result of and the presupposition for the meaningfulness of unfolding history. So at the end of the day, he'd want to anchor our knowledge, which is not certain until the final future, in the being of God to come, even while he affirms the constitutive function of history for that being of God.
Right.
But your mention of Rahner and the Vorbegriff, Pannenberg says almost the exact same thing. And I remember, maybe we talked about this, Camden, years ago, but he begins anthropologically, even though he believes God is the bearer of history and ultimately God will bring all of the contingent particulars into a united synthesis in the coming of his future kingdom. He says the way we begin talking about theology is by doing anthropology. Mm-hmm. And a constitutive feature of humanity is what he calls Weltoffenheit, openness beyond the world. That it's humans alone who are driven to change their circumstances, to look beyond their finite horizons and to imagine a comprehensive horizon of that at least at a minimum brings up the question of God. And so there's this, as you put it, kind of a primal awareness of the power of the open future that we call God. So he too has an anthropological, methodological starting point in doing his theology.
Mm-hmm. No, I can understand how that would fit into his theology. It is fascinating, as Jim mentioned earlier, there's so many themes and threads in Pannenbergian theology that it warrants further attention. Do you feel, you know, having completed a dissertation, that there's just so much more you'd be interested in exploring?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've just scratched the surface, to be honest. I mean, one thing you guys know about writing a dissertation is you begin to realize how much is out there and how much you don't know. And, you know, I think there are other directions to take it. But already, even things unrelated to Pannenberg, I feel like doing the project has really helped me think through, again, redemptive history and epistemology and critical realism and post-foundationalism and all of these contemporary trends that are just kind of swirling around us. How do we bring to bear a revelational epistemology and a doctrine of the Trinity upon these things in a self-conscious way? And I think, for me, Pannenberg has been just a wonderful exercise in trying to develop those kinds of abilities. So it's been good. But I've honestly, it's a special thing for me to talk to you guys, because I've always thought, you know, Rahner and Bart and Pannenberg are just, they're swimming in similar circles, and yet they come out with such different
conclusions, but it's just really, really fascinating to think about all three of these from a reform perspective.
I agree.
For those who are out there that may be listening to us that are interested in modern theology, they've perhaps been steeped in everybody from Barth to Pannenberg, Rahner, Torrance, whoever the modern
Boltmann
or Boltmann or whatever
Boltmann
or Boltmann. That's right. Yeah. Or Boltmann. Yeah. What would be perhaps a counter perspective that you would recommend for them to consider in terms of reading perhaps another perspective on theology that we would regard perhaps as being more sound in keeping with biblical revelation? And we've already mentioned Van Til, of course, Voss. My thought is people who are interested in reading a very thought-provoking and engaging with modern thought a type of systematic theology, even though somewhat dated from our perspective, I would recommend someone like Bovink, you know, Herman Bovink's four volumes as being, I think, just a still an abiding gem of how to do systematic theology that's faithful to biblical revelation. But what would your thoughts be? What recommended readings would you offer those who perhaps haven't been yet exposed to confessional Reformed theology, being faithful to biblical revelation? Where would you direct them to go ahead and pick up and read?
I think your point about Bovink is so helpful, particularly because Bovink situates his Reformed reflections in the context of the full sweep of the church's reflection, all the way from the early church to the Middle Ages to modern thought through the Reformation. And just seeing how he derives his Reformed conclusions in the light of the sweep of thought that extends into the modern period is just so helpful. And he seems to constantly be bringing back Schleiermacher, Kant, Hegel, you know, these thinkers that try to offset what he's trying to do in his exposition of Reformed thought. So I cannot improve on Bovink. Maybe Camden's got some other ideas.
No, not particularly. I would encourage people to follow up and read Bovink, but you know, it's also something that you have to read widely, and I mean that in several ways. You have to read modern theology, but you want to have a foundation for the basics. You know, a friend of ours, Lane Tipton, many years ago, I think it was my first semester, I talked to him and just asked him, you know, what can I do to make the best of, you know, seminary education, you know, coming in, you know, what kind of practices and things ought I to do as a student to make sure that, you know, I don't waste my time. And, you know, he really just kind of focused my attention, of course, on reading the scriptures and prayer and, you know, piety and general things like that. But in terms of theological disciplines, on focusing on the basics, and you got to think of him more or less like, the core exercises. If anyone's ever into weightlifting, you do basic things, you know, military press, bench press, squats, you know, just compound movements, things like that. And if you don't have those basics down, you're not going to build the muscular structure, the skeletal muscular structure to be able to do anything more advanced. And so you gotta get the basics down and be very conversant and rock solid on figures like Calvin. I would throw Bovink in there, maybe even Hodge, of course, Van Til, from our perspective, Voss. I'd throw in a dash of Klein. You know, you get these basics, and you know them well, and you build up those muscular structures, so that when you do come to a Pannenberg or a Barth, or you start doing some more modern theology and looking at it, you'll have a way to deal with it. Because if you go to the other stuff first, you'll get all messed up and injured. So,
right.
I think that's a helpful way to do it. So there's no quick fix necessarily to say, well, this is the one book, you know, or the one guy you want to read. But I think Bovink is close, and it's not a quick fix because it's massive
Camden,
corpus.
Camden, that answer was eminently helpful. That was very, very good. And let me just go ahead and echo that. That very, very helpful for our listeners. You know, do exactly what Camden suggested here.
Jim, if I could add one thing, I would of course agree with Camden, but I would put it in a maybe in a little bit of a stronger way. It's negative form. If you are not doing that, if you are not going back again and again to the basics of a revelational epistemology of becoming very familiar with what are we talking about when we talk about organic progression of special revelation in history and in scripture? How do we understand the testaments to relate to one another? How does the triune being of God relate to history? If you're not going back to the luminaries of our tradition and getting really convinced of those things, then I would advise people not to dive into modern theology because it's just such a swirl of differences of opinion, of philosophical moves that can really become bewildering. And ultimately, if we're being honest here, damaging to the church. And so I would just completely echo what you said, Camden, but also issue a little bit of a warning not to do this. And frankly, I don't consider myself to be the master of the Reformed basics, but I can tell you I had to go back to them again and again in studying Pannenberg because, you know, you feel the sway, you begin to understand how influential these thinkers can be, and if you're not continually returning to edifying scriptural material, it can be harmful spiritually and academically.
You know, Dr. Gaffin's ST101 has been available in the past on iTunes U. I hope it's still up there. If not, we'll appeal to the powers that be that they put it back there. But someone might say, you know, that's ST101. It's like the first systematics class you take. You know, I'm beyond that. I'm third year or I'm a PhD student or whatever. That's the kind of stuff no one graduates from.
Right.
Like, yes, you hope that you take the class, that you do well, that you understand it. But I went back to it and listened to it. I've listened to it many times. And that's the stuff that you always have to steep yourself in to be reminded of it. And then you learn it in layers. You learn it even more thoroughly. And of course, you never do theology apart from the scriptures. You always have to be reading and understanding the scriptures and studying them, meditating on them. But, you know, don't presume that you are beyond, you know, some of these things, just the basics of revelation and what that means. And the moment we do presume that we've graduated from some of those basic foundational issues, that's the moment I think we're most vulnerable to someone like a Pannenberg. And we always have to go back because their version will sound very much, Jim knows this, the language of Bart sounds very, very much like Reformed theology, but it's the furthest thing from it.
You know, if I could just one last thing here and then I'm done, I promise, I really. Just, you know, the thing my experience found in the best of the Reformed seminary experiences that are out there right now that offer well-rounded, faithfully Reformed education, my experience is that they really do a good job at grounding you not only in the basics that we've been talking about, but also exposing you in a proper way to modern thought, modern theology, being able to critically engage, so that there tends to be a commitment towards a well-rounded education engagement. So it's not just sort of like, you know, trying to train a bunch of people to be 16th century theologians, you know, with their head in the ground, you know, rather also having an engagement with what's going on, be able to critically engage. And I think you guys have brought out well how that, especially Camden's comments about Gaffin's, course, the intro to systematics. And it's just, I that really great, basic stuff that I think our listeners would really benefit from to give some reflection to. So,
yeah. Thank you guys both. That's very well said.
Well, Carlton, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us today. It's been a fantastic, wonderful discussion. I hope we've been able to open up Pannenberg in a way that's helpful to the listeners, but I trust that they've understood at least his basic points and know where to go from here. So thanks so much for taking the time today, Carlton. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, guys. It's been a pleasure. It's mine.
Absolutely. Well, we want to point people back to our website. Of course, you can visit us online at reformedforum.org. There you will find information about all of our programs, as well as a whole host of episodes on Barth and other features of modern theology. And you can download all of the episodes we've ever done. They're all online and they're all freely available. As I like to say, just like open source software, it's free libre and free gratis. So it's open and available. You just do a little bit of a search or browse through the website. You can find what you're looking for. If you got any questions, you can, of course, email us at mail@reformedforum.org or tweet us at Reformed Forum. We hope to hear from you, and we want to thank you so much for listening and hope you join us again next time on Christ Center.